listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about a space that might feel more special now than ever, the Art Museum. A museum docent in Milwaukee joins us to talk about the comfort that art can bring right now and what it's like to be back in a museum after months of closures. First, in an opinion piece written by our next guest, the idea that there is systemic racism in U.S. police departments is a myth, and she says there's data to back it up. The Washington Post has been keeping track of the number of civilians killed by police in recent years. Since 2015, it's been around 1,000 per year. In 2019, just 14 were unarmed black victims. Proportionally speaking, this year's numbers look about the same. When you factor in all the arrests officers make each year and how often they're attacked with deadly weapons, our guest says that law enforcement is not out of control. But she says there is also room for improvement. Heather McDonald is a fellow at the Manhattan Institute and the author of multiple books, including The War on Cops, How the New Attack on Law and Order Makes Everyone Less Safe. Heather, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Mr. Ferret. I greatly appreciate it.
Well, I summed up your argument a little bit there. Can you give us a little more detail? Why do you say that the case that there's systemic racism in police departments is overblown?
You're absolutely right. That's a good way to sum it up. Policing needs to be understood in the context of crime. Policing today is data-driven. Cops go where people are most being victimized. And sadly, that is overwhelmingly in minority neighborhoods. And once there, they are going to be interacting disproportionately with suspects who are black, because that is the profile that they are, or the reality that they're given. The CDC tells us that blacks die of homicide at 13 times the rate of whites, blacks between 10 and 43. That is a problem. That is a civil rights problem that we should all be concerned about. And the people who are killing blacks at that 13 times higher rate are not the police. It's not other whites, but it's overwhelmingly black criminals. Those data, again, determine where officers are deployed, where they're trying to save lives. The other thing that determines police deployment are calls from the community. And, Mr. Ferret, I've never been to a police community meeting in a high-crime area, whether it's Central Harlem or the south side of Chicago, where I do not hear those good, law-abiding, hardworking people beg for more police protection. It's people like Mrs. Sweeper, a cancer amputee in the Mount Hope section of the Bronx, who said to me, "Police, Jesus, send more police," because the only time she felt safe to go into her building lobby was when the police were there, because it was otherwise colonized by trespassing youth who were smoking weed and selling drugs. So the picture that we need to fill out in our national narrative about the police is why they are in the communities they are, and it is to save lives, and it's overwhelmingly to save black lives.
We hear kind of daily experiences from black people a lot here in Wisconsin, from our callers and guests sometimes and around the country, that black people, some of them feel like they've been over-policed, singled out in a situation where white people might not be. Do you think there's anything to that perception?
Well, there is nothing more infuriating or humiliating and sometimes terrifying than being stopped when you're innocent of any wrongdoing. And that is an experience that is disproportionately experienced by black males. Sadly, that is a crime tax that they pay, because given the reality of criminal offending in this country, blacks commit about 60% of all robberies and homicides, even though they're 13% of the population. Compared to whites, they commit homicide at around 11 to 12 times the rate. It's more likely that an innocent black male is going to be stopped at some point in his life because he meets some sort of suspect description, or the police are flooding an area because there's been a drive-by shooting. That is a reality that is tragic, but can only be ended by bringing down inner-city crime. There are 36 black children who have been killed in drive-by shootings since late May. if there had been 36 white children killed in drive-by shootings since late May, there would be a national revolution. It's all the media would talk about. It turns out the press really does not give a damn about black lives. We don't know the names of those 36 black children unless they've been taken by a cop. There are instances for sure where innocent black males have been stopped and questioned. But that is not the predominant reality. The predominant reality is officers being called into neighborhoods because that's where the drive-by shootings are happening. They are not happening in white neighborhoods. And if they were, believe me, there would be an immense outcry.
Talking to Heather McDonald from the Manhattan Institute, she says the perception that police have a systemic racism problem is overblown. She says we don't have disproportionate police violence against people of color. Heather, in your piece that caught our attention, you said despite that, you do see some room for improvement. What kind of changes would you like to see?
I would love to see more hands-on, realistic tactical training. I know officers in Chicago, nearby Wisconsin, who pay for their own tactical training because their departments are not giving enough, especially in service. We need to make sure that officers never find themselves in a situation where they feel they need to use lethal force because they don't have adequate backup or they have not taken cover. They need training in stress control. These are highly volatile situations that they face. Things are moving at a split-second basis. They need control of their emotions so that they can slow things down emotionally cognitively in making those shoot-don't-shoot decisions. I have to say, though, again, there is no evidence that officers shoot unarmed blacks at a higher rate than unarmed whites, just the contrary. And there's also no evidence that white officers shoot unarmed blacks at a higher rate than black officers. Again, the opposite is the case if you look at the data we've got. I would have more de-escalation training, although sadly a review of the literature finds that it doesn't change very much. And officers do need training in courtesy and respect. We all know that officers develop hardened attitudes towards the public. In part, let's admit, it's because these days in particular, when they get out of their car to make a lawful arrest, they find themselves often surrounded by hostile, jeering crowds, sometimes assaulting them, sometimes throwing things at them. In New York City, we have the phenomenon of so-called airmail, which is things like bags of feces and urine thrown at officers off the roofs of public housing projects. But officers do need to treat everybody with absolute, immaculate courtesy and respect, and often they develop a very brusque attitude. What I would not waste money on, Mr. Ferret, is implicit bias training. I've sat through one of those outside of St. Louis, by one of the premier deliverers of such implicit bias training. It's a joke. It's an insult to officers' intelligence. What never came up in an entire day of training was the issue of inner-city crime. And these cops who were black, white, and Hispanic were scratching their head and saying, what do you expect us to do? 75% of our shoplifting calls in the local mall are regarding black suspects, teenagers, even though blacks are 2% of the population. How else are we supposed to respond if not to those calls? So that is something that is being pushed by one side of the political debate now, and it is a huge waste of time that money should go into, as I say, training that allows officers to do their jobs with more tactical precision and self-control.
As we wrap up, we've seen calls in Wisconsin from actually a local conservative group calling for more transparency and consistent data collection for all police use of force, whatever side of the political spectrum you're on, so we all are working from the same data and the same basis. What do you think of that?
More transparency, the better. But here's what we need to do, Mr. Ferret. Match it with transparency on crime commission. match it with transparency on resisting arrest. I got data several years ago from Chicago that showed that blacks were arrested for resisting arrest at 10 times the rate of whites. Now, that needs to be accounted for, you know, put into perspective of the arrest rates generally. But by all means, you know, we have lots of racial profiling data collection mandates. They are never accompanied, coupled with a crime collection data, whether it's speeding violations, resisting arrest, drive-by shootings. Officer activity, the big lacuna in our discourse about the police today is we compare policing activity to population data. That is the wrong benchmark. Policing activity has to be put in the context of criminal violations. And when you do that, study after study shows that there are not racial disparities. There are not disparities in use of lethal force or non-lethal use of force.
We'll leave it there. Heather, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Mr. Parrott. Thank you for the conversation.
Heather McDonald is a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, contributing editor at City Journal, and author of several books. We talked with her about why she makes the case that there's not evidence of widespread racial bias in policing. Coming up, we hear from a Milwaukee Art Museum docent about what it's been like to be reunited with the museum after many months away. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's our look at some of the top stories out of Washington, including Senate Democrats talking about getting rid of the filibuster. First, things like visiting a friend or family member or going to the grocery store have taken on more meaning for some of us in the last few months. Another visit that might feel extra special right now is a trip to the art museum. Many art museums around the state that had closed during the shelter-in-place period have opened back up over the late summer or early fall. The Trout Museum in Appleton, the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend are both open and operating with limited hours, to name just a couple. Have you been able to visit a museum, art or otherwise, that has reopened? Tell us about your experience at 800-642-1234. If you haven't visited lately but like to do it, tell us what you miss and what you love about a trip to the museum. Call in now at 800-642-1234. The Milwaukee Art Museum reopened to the public in mid-July with limited hours. They've been operating with an online system to buy tickets in advance for a date and time slot. Petey Basson has been a docent at the Milwaukee Art Museum since 2009 and served as docent chair from 2016 to 2018. Before becoming a docent, Petey taught English at the University School of Milwaukee for nearly 40 years. Petey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, you've been involved with the museum for many years now. What was it like when you were first able to re-enter the museum after it was closed this year?
Well, Rob, you spoke a little bit earlier about the loneliness, I think, that many people are feeling. We miss our friends. We miss family members who live in parts away from us. And I think we also have a kind of a cultural loneliness that many of us experience, loneliness for other times and places, the kind of artwork that takes us to other times and places. So for me, it was a real shot in the arm to get a chance to go back to the museum.
Were there a few pieces of art that you really missed? You were really looking forward to making an acquaintance with again?
Absolutely. I went right to the Renaissance galleries when I first came. There's a piece by a woman, a painter, which is already something unusual for its time, Sofonisba Anguissola, a painter in the mid-1500s, painted a wonderful portrait of her sister, Minerva. It's such a loving piece. Minerva's dressed in her finest, and she's wearing gorgeous kind of coral-colored jewelry. She has a beautiful complexion. And it was especially gratifying to me to see that piece by Sofonisba, because I know that Sofonisba painted this painting of her sister Minerva when she was herself separated from her sister. And I think that it reminds me of the numbers of ways in which we long to be with the people we love. I love that piece. And also, frankly, because it's a Renaissance piece, it brings us back to a kind of a more golden era than the one we're living in. And it was a satisfaction to see that. So that was one of several that I enjoyed seeing again.
Well, I love that idea. I mean, in general, of a way to think about art as a way to connect to another human being, maybe separated by a lot of miles and a lot of centuries.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. But that's not the only thing I enjoyed. There are some pieces at the museum that help us understand the events of our day today. There's a large piece called Come On Out by an African-American artist named Glenn Ligon. Mm-hmm. And he was responding to an incident of violence and criminal injustice that occurred in the 1960s. His work is a more contemporary work, but he was reflecting on the incident that involved the Harlem six men who were sent to prison for a murder that they didn't commit. And the piece is quite a horizontal piece. It takes up, I don't know how many yards of one wall, and it's covered in text. And the text says, and it's kind of blurry, you can't always read every single part of it. The text says, come on out and show them. One of the members of the Harlem Six pressed on a bruise to make it bleed so that the police officer would see how much he was hurting. It reminds me of the chants that we have heard in the last couple of months, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. And so that work, painted long before this moment that we're in, makes me understand something about our current time. So that's another reason to go to the museum, to remind us of who we are now and what we're facing now.
Talking to P.D. Bassin, docent at the Milwaukee Art Museum, talking about the experience of going back to the museum after it was closed for months. You can join in if you'd like quickly at 800-642-1234 if you've been back to a museum. P.D., I watched a video that the Milwaukee Art Museum put out about, you know, the procedures. What's a little different now? Could you talk us mm-hmm. through what a visit to the museum is like now?
Well, first of all, it's pretty easy. You can get your tickets. You can reserve your tickets online in a flash. Doesn't take long. You do have to commit to a day and a time. It's a reserved ticket. Then once you enter the museum and get your ticket, you're directed to go down a particular hall and follow the arrows. So instead of being able to wander at will from room to room, we do need to stay on a path in order to keep a good 6 feet distance from each other. However, having said that, The path takes us throughout the whole bottom floor of the museum, and we get to see a representation of the artworks that the museum houses. It is a little sad not to be able to go up to the second floor. I miss the works in the Bradley Gallery, although some of them have been brought down to the first floor so that we can see them. I have one painting in particular, Gabriella Munter's painting Boating, that is important to me. And that's been moved from the second floor to the first floor. But other than that, we follow the path, and it takes us through the different centuries. We get to see some decorative art, some jewelry, and then exit the museum almost in a loop from the way we came.
Can you talk about your role as a docent and what docents do?
Docents interact with the visitors to the museum and show them some of the things in the museum that are meaningful to they themselves and to the visitors, what the visitors might want to see. A lot of us docents work with children, school children who come to the museum. And I have to tell you, that's one of the things that I miss. Maybe you remember, or maybe you're not old enough to remember, but maybe you remember that movie, The King and I, with Deborah Kerr. And she says in one of the songs that she sings, when you become a teacher, by your pupils you'll be taught. Well, that's the experience of a docent as well. You take kids through or adults through, and what they see and what they bring to the experience teaches you something. So that's a sadness not to have that experience right now.
Can you give a little pep talk for people to get out and visit their local museum, even if they're not in your neighborhood, to get out and see what their local museum has to offer?
Those local museums have a lot to offer. I have to just share with you, I had a five-year-old grandson come to visit me from from Massachusetts just last week, and we went to the Milwaukee Public Museum with him. And it was a shot in the arm to see that little kid looking at the skeletons and the skeleton of the humpback whale. He was wide-eyed to see that. Museums give us a lot that we need right now. And I would encourage people to visit those repositories of culture that are near them, and maybe even make some trips to ones that are a little bit out of their way.
Do you feel like, obviously, you're someone who already appreciated the art museum a lot, given your commitment to it? Do you feel that even more now after this last few crazy months?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a heartache not to go. The museum can lift your spirits in a way nothing else can. And, you know, we need our spirits lifted these days. It can be pretty tough if you're separated from the things that you love in so many other ways. It's a real satisfaction to go into that wonderful building. And, boy, you walk into the Quadracci Pavilion and, you just can't help but soar a little bit. It's a beautiful space, and it's an important space for us to treasure right now.
Petey, thanks a lot for sharing it with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
That's Petey Bassin. Petey's been a docent at the Milwaukee Art Museum since 2009, served as a docent chair from 2016 to 2018. We have been talking about the joy of getting back into a museum when we couldn't for months there. If you want to give a shout out to your own local museum, send us an email. Whether you work there, volunteer there, or just a fan of it, and let us know how it's going, if it's reopened, if it's about to reopen, email us, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you can always tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Let us know about your local museum and what's going on there these days. Coming up after the news, Congress is back in session, but are they any closer to a deal on additional coronavirus relief spending? We'll find out about that and more in our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up today at 6, polls suggest most Americans are extremely or very motivated to vote this year, but many still expect turnout in November to be low. Jen White asks why today on 1A+ here on the Ideas Network. First is our weekly look at some of the top headlines out of the nation's capital. Congress is back in session this week after a recess. There continues to be a stalemate on additional coronavirus relief funding. A funding bill needs to come together to prevent a government shutdown at the end of the month. And Democrats in the Senate are talking about the possibility of doing away with the legislative filibuster if they manage to win a majority this fall. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think the U.S. Senate should get rid of the filibuster, where, in effect, to do stuff you need 60-plus votes? Why or why not? Do you think doing so would damage the institution of the Senate, like Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and other Republicans say? Would changing the legislative filibuster make any difference in how the Senate does its job? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Jennifer Habercorn covers Congress for the LA Times. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with this evergreen topic over the last few months now, the efforts to pass some kind of new COVID-19 relief bill. A lot going on here. First of all, Speaker Pelosi saying, what, the House is going to stay in session until they get something done? What does that mean?
She did say that, and Democrats do want to stay in Washington. In effect, it does not sound like they actually will. Once they leave sometime this month, they're going to be essentially on standby for 24-hour notice. I think she kind of made those comments looking for the headline. They're going to, and the image that they're going to be here working hard, talking. But the fact of the matter is, not much has actually changed on the process of getting closer to a COVID bill. She has not resumed negotiations with the White House. There's a lot of posturing right now, and there's a lot of concern that there isn't a bill. But the negotiations have not restarted, and frankly, there's not even very much movement to get to a deal.
Let's give a listen to Speaker Pelosi making that announcement. She actually said this on CNBC yesterday.
I just got off a call with my colleagues. We are committed to staying here until we have an agreement that meets the needs of the American people. We're optimistic that the White House, at least, will understand that we have to do some things. We have had a disagreement on crushing the virus, and that's a very important part of the HEROES Act, testing, tracing.
It does sound a little bit like they're going to break out the sleeping bags there. Clearly, that's not what's going to happen. But let's talk about some of the points of disagreement. Speaker Pelosi mentioned that HEROES Act. That's something the House passed, what, months ago now. What was in that just didn't fly at all in the Senate?
The main issue that Republicans and the Senate had with that bill, which passed back in May, was that it was too expensive in their eyes. It was more than a $3 trillion bill. Senate Republicans want something more in the neighborhood of $1 trillion. And there has been a bit of movement on that over time. The House has said they would come down about $1 trillion, and they asked the White House to come up $1 trillion, but there's still very little agreement. In fact, President Trump tweeted today that Republicans should increase their number above $1 trillion. And Republicans on Capitol Hill basically said no today. They said that they don't, you know, really think that a package needs to be more than $1 trillion. And then once you dig into the policy that's in there, House Democrats really want about $1 trillion for state and local governments so that they can pay their police officers, firefighters, public employees. And a lot of Republicans are really skeptical about that. They call that a blue state bailout. And they say that states that were financially mismanaged before the crisis are trying to take advantage of this to get more money. Of course, every state is different, and we could dig into that a little bit, but that's one of the main points of disagreement. There's also disagreement as to whether stimulus checks should be given to individuals, how much enhanced unemployment, if you remember those $600 checks, whether those should continue and at what amount. So there's quite a few areas of disagreement between Republicans and Democrats at this point.
Yeah, let's look at that stimulus issue. As you said, the president tweeted that should be part of a new bill. It was, I believe, part of the Democrats in the House, their HEROES Act. They're still pulling for that. Not part of Senate Republican proposals at any point. Is that right?
It was part of a plan, about a month ago, 6 weeks ago now, but it was not part of their latest proposal.
Got it. And now we had the Problem Solvers Caucus in the U.S. House, Democrats, Republicans getting together on this. They came up with something. Can you briefly let us know what they were looking at and then the reception their idea got?
Yeah, they were looking at about a $1.5 trillion plan. Obviously, they were trying to split the difference between Republicans and Democrats. And it included many of the proposals that everyone wants, but in smaller amounts, such as funding for state and local governments and stimulus checks. But it was very quickly rejected by House Democrats House Democratic leaders who feel like they kind of need to do all or nothing. They don't want to pass piecemeal bills that get at small pieces of this without tackling the big problem. But what the Problem Solvers Caucus plan really exposes is that there's many rank and file House Democrats who are getting very frustrated that they haven't been able to come up with a deal. As we mentioned, the HEROES Act passed the House back in May. There's been no substantial movement since then. And they're going to be on the ballot in just a couple weeks. And they really feel like they need to go home to their constituents and say that they got something done. Not that they passed something in the House, but they got it done. And so they're really urging House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to get back to the bargaining table, urging her to get something done, even if it's not everything that Democrats want. But Democratic leadership right now feels like they need to go for the big bill or nothing at all.
We're talking to Jennifer Habercorn from the LA Times about some of the top stories in national politics, mostly looking at Congress. In a little bit, we're going to talk about the filibuster. Some Democrats and some Democratic supporters say if Democrats win the Senate in the fall. It's a big if. But if they do, they say they should try to end the filibuster to try to be able to get more done with a Democratic Senate. What do you think of that idea? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Jennifer, that concern as people are running for re-election, the entire House is, a lot of the Senate, a third of the Senate is, and of course, you know, this guy's running for president. That sense you were saying from some moderate Democrats in particular, I think, worried that they would take the fallout if something doesn't get passed. I mean, doesn't in the public's eye, doesn't everybody get a little bit of the blame? And maybe depending on where you're looking at it from, you're going to blame the other side?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I particularly pointed out the moderate House Democrats who are up for re-election because they are in the most competitive districts. You know, you think about control of the House really swings on the parts of the country that are the most centrist, that flip back and forth between Republican and Democrat, you know, every couple terms. And in those races, they're very tight right now. And the power of incumbency is that you can deliver legislation that your constituents want. And obviously, the economy is still struggling in the wake of the pandemic and the shutdowns it prompted. And they feel like their constituents really need this additional assistance and want to see the economy improve. And so for that reason, they want to see a deal. They want to see money flowing from the federal government out into the pockets of their constituents.
I use the word shutdown there. Speaking of that, another thing that could happen is if a spending bill isn't passed, we could have a government shutdown. And it seemed like there was a while, a couple few years back, where, I don't know, it seemed like every 10 minutes there was a deadline to avert another government shutdown. What's going on this time?
You're right. So the government is due to run out of money on September 30th, which is 2 weeks from today. As of right now, everyone, I should say, the White House and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi are on the same page that they don't want a government shutdown. You know, when we've seen these the last couple of years, they rarely play well for anyone. It just makes Congress look incredibly inept, and the White House for that matter. And so there is agreement that they want to avoid a shutdown. They want to pass a bill to fund the government as soon as they can and as cleanly as they can. They don't want to attach any policy such as further COVID relief to that effort. Of course, it's too early to say whether that they're going to be successful in that and whether they can pass a bill to fund the government without the risk of a shutdown. But as of right now, everyone's saying the right thing, and I don't anticipate a shutdown. The question is going to be how long they fund the government for, if they fund it through November, if they fund it into December or into next year, and kind of when we're going to see this clip again and when we're going to see this, you know, potential drama play out the next time.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Troy is with us in Muskego. Troy, hi.
Hello. Yes, I definitely think if the Democrats take over the Congress in November, that most definitely the reason why things are being held up right now is because of the Republicans, and definitely get a bigger stimulus package for everybody with this pandemic. Now, there's a big question that I always hear everybody say. They keep saying, well, who do you think is going to pay for all this? And I'm going to tell everybody right now, me, the taxpayer. And that's what I want my taxes going for. I pay into this system. So when there's a pandemic in times like this, that I get that money, I get helped out during a pandemic.
Troy, thanks a lot for the call. Troy, hoping it sounds like for total Democratic control of Congress to end the gridlock. That's, I guess, probably what Senator Schumer and others are working for, too. Everybody probably has their eye over their shoulder on Election Day, right?
Oh, for sure.
Oop, you still there, Jennifer? There you go.
Yeah, they're hoping for a full sweep this fall so that they can control all of government next year. And they're starting to put together an agenda for what they would do if that's the case. You know, we don't have a ton of detail as to what that's going to be right now, at least in the weeds. But that's what they're rooting for.
Thanks for that call, Troy. We are talking to Jennifer Habercorn, congressional reporter for the L.A. Times, looking at Congress back in session, what's on agendas, coronavirus relief, avoiding a government shutdown. And coming up, we'll follow up on what Jennifer was saying there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. The filibuster, should it stay or should it go? Some Democratic supporters saying go, hoping for a Democratic majority and getting rid of the filibuster, they say, would let Democrats get more stuff done. There are worries about the long-term impact on the the Senate, how it exists, its prestige, its regard among the American public. Join in with your reactions at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with LA Times congressional reporter Jennifer Habercorn. It's our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. Let's take a couple callers on the stimulus issue before we move on to the filibuster. Bill is with us in Hale's Corners. Bill, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up?
I was curious. I read an article yesterday that talked about a group of a bipartisan group of congressmen putting together an alternate bill, an alternate recovery bill that was in the $1.3 or $1.4 trillion range. And I'm just curious to know if your guest knows anything about that or if that's still in play or what's up.
Thanks for the call. Jennifer, that's that Problem Solvers Caucus we talked about a little earlier, right? That's the bipartisan effort?
Yes. Yes, that's right. And as we mentioned, Democratic leadership basically said, no way. We don't believe that the response that the pandemic warrants $1.3 trillion response. It warrants more in the neighborhood of $2 or $3 trillion response. So it was pretty quickly rejected by House Democratic leadership. But the members, Republicans and Democrats, are still pushing it.
Thanks for calling in. We'll go to Tom now in Crandon. Tom, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I would like to say, how come the real truth never comes out about what the Democrats really want all that money for, to bail out California and New York? Now, if it's COVID and people that need the money, I am all for it. But I am sick and tired of the Democrats lying, and they say, oh, it's Republicans, they're not going to. No, the Republicans have stood firm and said, what's happening in California is their own fault. It's not me living in Wisconsin. It's not anyone else. And what happens in New York, that's their fault. And it's all Democrat run, all of it.
Tom, thanks for the call. Jennifer, is there any sign that, and I think he's referring to that state and local aid, that states like New York and California would disproportionately benefit from that kind of aid?
You know, the caller is getting at a concern a lot of Republicans mm-hmm. have. They've referred to this as a blue state bailout. You know, obviously I write for a paper based in California, so I'm a bit familiar with this. And actually, California had a rainy day fund that it was going through, you know, very quickly at the beginning of the pandemic. And the Republican concern is that states that were fiscally irresponsible before the bailout, before the pandemic, would get money to resolve their issues. You know, frankly, they point to a state like Illinois more than California. But, you know, Democrats say this, you know, the pandemic has hit every state. There's people in every state that are suffering. Every state is going through this process, and the money would not disproportionately affect states that had poor financial standing before the crisis.
Tom, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. It's our weekly look at some of the latest news in national politics. Jennifer Habercorn with us from the LA Times, congressional reporter there. You can join in, of course, at 800-642-1234. Well, a lot of people want to talk about the relief efforts this week. Jennifer, so let's go to Alex and Rhinelander. Alex, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to bring up the fact that earlier this year, the Republican Senate was more than happy to pass the $3 trillion bailout for corporate interest. And so in this kind of time where we're thinking about the next bill, I just think it's rather ironic that now the Republicans are a little hesitant to help actual people out.
Alex, thanks a lot for the call. Alex, referring, I think, to the CARES Act. But part of that was going toward businesses, but not all of it. Right, Jennifer?
That's right. The most substantial grants, which could turn into loans, that went to businesses. I should point out that that was very widely supported by both Republicans and Democrats. And the program proved to be very popular. And there is discussion that, you know, if one of these bills could come together, there would be a second round of that grant program.
Thanks a lot for that call. Well, I've been teasing the filibuster this whole time. We better get to it, Jennifer, before we run out of time. Now, some Democrats talking about possibly, if they win the Senate, not a sure thing, certainly, the idea of getting rid of the filibuster. What are we hearing?
So the filibuster is the 60-vote threshold that the Senate rule has. If legislation wants to pass it, it only needs 50 votes, but it needs us to pass 60 votes before that, before you can get to that final vote and for it to become law. And Democrats are considering just getting rid of that 60-vote requirement so that you'd only have one vote. It would be 50, and a bill would move to the president's desk or move over to the House after that. They argue that Republicans have obstructed in the Senate and that they worry that they would Republicans would do so even under a Biden administration. So everything Democrats want to do would just be held up by Republicans in the Senate. So they're considering getting rid of it. The argument against getting rid of it, which there are some Democrats who embrace, say that, you know, if you only have a 50-vote threshold, then you're going to see legislation just dramatically changing, kind of flipping back and forth, depending on whether Republicans or Democrats are in charge. The 60-vote threshold provides some stability that you can't just go in and flip-flop between legislation, you know, every 2 years, 4 years, or 6 years. So Democrats are considering this. They haven't made any final decision on what they're going to do. But progressives are really putting pressure on Democrats right now to be prepared to do this if the Senate does flip hands to Democrats and Biden goes to the White House.
Let's give a listen to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and his response to these calls.
This threat to permanently disfigure the Senate has been the latest growing drumbeat in the modern Democratic Party's war against our governing institutions.
Now, Jennifer, in some ways, the filibuster has been chipped away at. Democrats, in effect, got rid of it for certain court appointments. Republicans, when they took over, got rid of it, in effect, for Supreme Court appointments. We're chiseling away at the filibuster already, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely. And as you said, both parties are responsible for some of that. And Democrats started it when they did away with the filibuster for nominations. So, you know, you could argue this is just a continuation of that. This would be a very dramatic continuation of it. But in some ways, it feels inevitable because, as you mentioned, it's just been chipped away at. And, you know, I should add that the stark partisan divide in the Senate, which has just grown dramatically worse in the 15 years that I've been in Washington, is truly to blame for some of this because there are no conversations that happen between Republicans and Democrats. You know, they could tell you that they get along with each other, but when it comes to actually moving legislation, you know, you're a Republican or you're a Democrat, and there's very little wiggle room. You know, I think you see that when there's stories about major votes and it's one, maybe two Republicans or Democrats vote, you know, with the other side on legislation. You just never see them leaving their camps on major issues anymore. And that's really contributed to the spirit of, you know, I'm not even going to let you advance your legislation because I'm so starkly opposed to it. And I'm worried about a primary at home if I help you in any way.
Jennifer, thanks again for joining us today.
It was great to talk with you.
That's Jennifer Habercorn, who covers Congress for the LA Times. We talked through about some of the top stories in national politics this week. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the author of a new book looks into some of the reasons for a decline in the American middle class, offers suggestions on how to bring it back, and tries to bust some myths along the way. It's been an unusual tourism season in Wisconsin and around the country. Now that Labor Day is over, we'll find out what the numbers look like for one of the state's hottest tourist regions and what it means for our overall economy here in Wisconsin. And people without college degrees can face unfair bias in the United States, according to the author of a new book on meritocracy and where it goes wrong. Get the details and join in with your thoughts. All that, plus a look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Yesterday, we talked to Justin Barney from Radio Milwaukee about the ways we listen to our music, with the news that vinyl albums are outselling CDs for the first time since the 1980s. You can check out the conversation, give it a listen at our archives, wpr.org/centraltime. A lot of you joined in with your great stories, and we heard from more of you on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David writes, everything is on the iPod now. If I had an album I liked a lot, I bought it online. Dee Dee writes, funny, the music of a lifetime of singing and listening has washed over me during this pandemic, from nursery rhymes, camp song, protest songs, folk, all of them. Yo-Yo Ma, Andrea Bocelli. Dee Dee says, it's all good. Ed says, my listening habits have broadened out just the same as I have. And then here's an interesting fact that I missed yesterday. A listener named Rochelle writes, on 9/15/1965, September 15th, 1965, Ford became the first automaker to put 8-track players in their cars. Now, I checked it out online. It looks like that is, in fact, true. Ford released the 1966 Mustang that day with an optional 8-track player. So yesterday was the 55th anniversary of the car 8-track player. I feel like my folks had one car with an 8-track player in it, and we had a pretty limited selection, to be honest. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.